part 2 of Report, or short extracts on the book from Life on OLD Atlantis from approximately 21,500 years ago. A Dweller on Two Planets. Taken through by Frederick S. Oliver, from 1905. On Atlantis they had a real insight into the psychic world and the meaning of the thought, and understanding that everything is vibration, quote. Study will show thee that the laws of the physical world continue inward to their spiritual source, that they are, truly, but prolongations the one of the other. But entering into the realm of vibration, whose doorkeeper is sound, we find that the one substance vibrates in variant, but definite, dynamic degree, and that thence arise each and all of the diverse forms of matter. In short, the difference between any given substances, as gold and silver, iron and lead, sugar and sand, is not one of matter, but of dynamic degree solely. The Poseidae, Atlantis people, found that in the realm beyond magnetism were yet other forces, superior and more intense of pulsation, forces operated by the mind. And mind is of our Father, and is the constantly creating source of all things whatsoever. Next extract, the posed investigator thus knew of wondrous forces of nature which he might bend to the uses of mankind. The secret was that attraction of gravitation, the law of weight, had set over against it the repulsion by levitation, that the first belonged to the light side of nature, and the second to Navas, the night side, that vibration govern the darkness and the cold. Next extract, quote semicolon this wisdom Atlantis found it possible to adjust weight, positiveness, to lack of weight negativeness, this achievement meant much. It meant aerial navigation without wings or unwieldy gas reservoirs, through taking advantage of repulsion by levitation opposed in overmatching strength to the attraction of gravitation. Next extract, imposed no wires or other sensible material connection was required in the use of either telephones or telephotes nor heat conduction. As also Tesla understood, but he was stopped in his development by the big money people already then for a century ago. Rune remark. Book also touched the measure system used in Atlantis but I do not enter into that here. Next extract, quote, the fact that students were often hard pressed for means on which to live was taken into account by the government, which in all of its dealings with this class allowed better terms than were accorded to any other social division. Next extract, the person telling this Atlantis story whose name then was Zalm Numenos has first been living Ru'al, on, near the mountains, but then later moved nearer the city for the study period. Next extract, it was customary with all newcomers in the city to make a visit to the Agako Palace and Gardens early as might be convenient after their arrival. 2 hours in each week the Rai, Emperor, sat in the reception hall, and during these 2 hours visitors thronged the corridors and passed in double ranks before the throne. After this ceremony, all who chore, boring routine work, were free to wander unrestricted through the gardens, visit the menagerie, where every known species of animal was kept, or to go through the Grand Museum or the Royal Library. With many it was a pleasurable custom frequently to spend the day at Agako, on which occasions lunches are brought and a quiet picnic held under the great trees beside fountain, lake or cataract. Next extract, he also talk about an advanced kind of surveillance sect.com a camera or like he saw in the city he came to not seemingly known by him beforehand. Next extract, when he came to the city he was able to ride in the transport system and saw surroundings so beautiful, quote. And this was a marriage of art and of science, from their union sprang the fair dream, a triumph of human skill and knowledge. Quote semicolon in every direction cars, carriages were coming, going, or addressed, containing people dressed as for a gala day, the various distinguishing colors of their turbans denoting their social rank. Posed, like other countries then and since, had its social castes, as the governmental, the literati and ecclesiastics, the artisans, a limited military, which served it as a police and sanitary corps, and so on through the usual familiar list. The apparel of all classes was fashioned in the same general style, until it came to the headdress. All of the people wore turbans, which article of raiment differed in color according to caste. There was no envy of one class by another. Next extract. The then ruling imperia, they seem to have been long living, like as the old forefathers told of in the Bible, able to live more than 10 times as long per incarnation compared of today's bodies. Quote, as antedating the reign of Rigwaksan, attention is called to a period of time embracing 4,340 years, inclusive of the main events of post-history. This interval, notwithstanding its long duration, had been singularly free from internecine wars, and, while not wholly unmarked by martial events, was certainly more peaceful than any subsequent world epoch of equal length occurring within the 120 centuries whose lapse furnishes the incidents of this history. Gwaksan was of a long line of honorable ancestors, and his house of the republican monarchial system had several times furnished successful candidates whom the people had placed on the throne during the 7 centuries that the present political system had ruled. At the initial date of the period referred to, the Pozidi, a powerful, numerous race of mountaineers, semi-civilized at best, but of splendid physique, had swept down like the wolf and had, in many sanguinary contests, finally conquered the pastoral people nomad folk of the plains, the Atlantides. As time went on, after many wars between the different regions, racial coalition obliterated all distinctions, so that the union resulted in producing Earth's greatest nation. Next extract, quote semicolon post came to found great colonies in North and South America, and in those 3 great remnants of Lemuria, of which Australia is but the 1/3 left to the world by that cataclysm which sunk Atlantis, also of how it founded certain large colonies in Eastern Europe at an age when there was no Western Europe, and in parts of Asia and Africa. Quote semicolon that day is not far off when thou wilt again uncover the knowledge, so, in that time, we transmuted clay, first raising its atomic speed so that it became white light of a pale illuminating power and then reducing it to the, so to speak, chemical milepost of aluminum, and this at a cost not nearly so great as in this modern day it takes to get iron from its ores. The mines of native metals, as gold, silver, copper, and so on, were valuable then, as now, requiring no processing save smelting. But a metal which might be obtained from any ledge of slate rock, or a bed of clay, was so inexpensive as to be the chief base metal in use. Quote, of aluminum was the giant tower of the Maxt constructed. I could see its base from where I stood, an enormous cube of masonry, then the superstructural round shaft of solid metal of the tower proper, a dully white, tapering column, lit by lunar rays. From base upward, my gaze traveled until it rested on the top, an apical point nearly 3,000 feet 1 kilometer, in height. Entranced by this crowning triumph of the scene, I gazed at the heaven-piercing shaft, sentinel over the garden city, warding off the lightnings, when the Lord of Thunder was abroad, and all my thought was of its grandeur, and its majestic beauty. Next extract. Atlantis names for America then, Amor and Inclia, that is, South and North America. Next extract. Truly, I have said that we believed in Inca, and symbolized him as the sun god, but the sun itself was an emblem. Next extract. The Atlantides were given to personification of the principles of nature and of the objects of the earth, seas and skies semicolon comma p88 comma, but this was purely a result of the national love of poetry, and could be mainly traced to the favor which popular fancy had accorded to a chronological epic history of Bozd, wherein the chief men and women figured as heroes and heroines. The powers of nature, such as wind, rain, lightning, heat and cold, and all kindred phenomena were gods of various degree, while the germinal principle of life, the destroying one of death, and other of life's greater mysteries, were characterized as the greater gods, but each and all were but offspring of the Most High Inca. Next extract. As a fact, the worship of Inca never included anything other than the adoration of God as a spiritual entity, and the gods had no portion in the religious services held on the two Sundays of each week, that is, the 11th and the first days, for with the Posidia week consisted of 11 days, just as a month comprised 3 weeks, and a year 11 months, with one or more leap year days at its end, as the exigencies of the solar calendar might require, these days being a regularly recurring holiday season, as New Year's Day is now. Next extract, in our monotheism we differed little from the religion dominating the Hebraic civilization, we recognized no divine trinity, nor any Christ spirit, neither any savior except the endeavor to do the best we knew in the sight of Inkel. We considered all mankind as the sons of God, not any one mysteriously conceived person as solely his son. Miracle was an impossible thing, for all things we deemed rationally referable to uncontrovertible law. From next chapter, a grave prophecy. Here he mention a time frame as he say it is the last weeks in the year 1116 BC. Next extract, in Atlantis any person was free to employ the morning hours even of the 11th day, as was day of rest, Sunday, in any manner most agreeable, whether at work or playful relaxation. With the first hour, however, an enormous and very sweet-toned bell pealed forth with an intense, reverberant boom, two strokes, paused a moment, then rang four tunes more. Thereupon all occupations ceased, and religious worship commenced. On the following day the great bell struck again, and throughout the length and breadth of a great continent other bells pealed synchronously. It was even so in the populous colonies of Amor and Inclia, the difference in time being calculated, and one man in the great temple of Inkel Inkfuel attended to this sweetly solemn duty. Then the season of worship was over, and the rest of the Inkelid first day was devoted to recreations of every sort. This is not to be construed that the worship was of a gloomy nature. Next extract. At a time some later he met a strange sage that foretold much of his destiny. Quote semicolon during the subsequent 4 years after my strange meeting with the tall and straight, white-haired old man who had prophesied concerning me, events, one after another shaped themselves in harmony with his forecast. In all that time we never met. Indeed I met him but once more before my death. From first of chapter 9, Curing Crime. As told first of the book he discovered ore of gold and silver after the volcanic eruption he witnessed and he later divulged this to some other persons, who tried to utilize this on private basis. But as all such resources was owned by the public or the common, those others was later judged, quote semicolon arrived at the court of the tribunes, I saw my mining partners there in custody, along with the incriminated purchaser of the gold. The judge of the court sat on the judicial divan on its raised platform, and by his side sat, in simple dignity, Gwoxon, Rai of the greatest nation of the earth, but he was nevertheless studiously observant of the fact that the judge was, as such, entitled to the place of first rank while in the hall. Several spectators were in the seats provided for the public in the auditorium. There they made a kind of psychic reading of the person's character and faults, flaws, and then the cure. Quote semicolon my diagnosis of the case, continued the Zarka. Having been confirmed by so high an authority, I will now apply the cure. Page 99. He summoned an attendant, who wheeled out another magnetic apparatus contained in a heavy metal case. Having placed this in a satisfactory condition of activity, the Zarka, Emperor, next applied its positive pole to that place on the head of the patient marked by the figure 1, and the other pole he placed at the back of the neck. He then took out his timepiece and laid it on the metal case of the instrument, near a dial the pointer of which he adjusted. All was then still, except the low-toned conversation in various parts of the room, during the ensuing half hour. At the end of this time the Zarka arose from his seat and changed the positive pole to the other side of the head, where the duplicate figure was marked. Then again a half hour's quiet, broken only by the exit of some of the spectators and the entrance of others. When the half hour had again elapsed, the operator changed the pole to the place marked 2. This time only half an hour was given to both sides of the head. I had been told by the emperor to remain. He bad only stayed a few moments after the beginning of the operation, which was not new to him. At the end of the work on the first man, B was taken from under the influence of the magnetic anesthetizer by merely reversing the poles of the instrument at a second application. Desire lectured upon the theme afforded by the operation while the first patient was being removed. To the considerable audience that had, by this time, assembled, he said, "You have seen the treatment of those mental qualities which tended through their predominance to warp his moral nature, something but partially developed. The process has been partially to atrophy the vascular channels supplying that portion of the brain where are located the organs of greed and of destruction. But mark well this point: after all is said, the soul is superior to the physical brain, and it is in the soul, the nature of the man, in which these criminal tendencies inhere, the brain and other organs being the seat of psychic expression, the business office, so to speak. Hence, merely to have mechanically hypnotized this subject would not accomplish our purpose. Hypnotizing is an indrawing, and the cerebral blood vessels contract and become partially bloodless. Indeed, they may become fatally empty. This art is a very dangerous one. But the opposite effect is produced in aphism, posed equivalent for the modern word mesmerism. The brain is filled with blood, and the reversion of the instrument cessated the hypnotic and initiated the aphic process. It is at this moment that the mind of the operator may assume control of the mind of the subject, and suggest to the erring soul a permanent cessation of the error. This man has been so treated, doubly treated, since not only has the blood supply been partially cut off which went to those organs where was the seat of his weakness, but with my will I have impressed his soul to cease its sin, and I have supplied it with a work to execute which will have a counteraction. He may be slightly ill for a few days, but his tendencies to sin will be gone. It requires a superior mind, which has gone wrong in several directions, to make a successful evildoer, and where the lower nature, chiefly a perverted sex nature, predominates, there will be found the criminal. Atlantis has no debauchees, for if a person shows such disposition, the state takes the wayward one in hand and operates upon the proper organs. But I need not dilate upon these subjects any further. Next extract: in the latter half of my fourth year of attendance there came to me one Prince Mainax. Mainax held the highest ministerial office of all the Aztec, the Rai's chief advisor, who desired to know whether I would accept the position of Secretary of Records, a position which gave opportunity to become familiar with every detail of post-government. He took this opportunity, "Thus I became one of the seven non-official, unenfranchised secretaries, who were entrusted with the writing of special reports and the care of many important state documents. Surely this was no small distinction to confer on one out of 9,000 Ziokini and a man, as yet, unenfranchised in a nation of 300 million people. If, in some sort, I owed it to merit, yet I was not more worthy than 100 other of my fellow students. Next extract: after some time the emperor gave him the offer to take a trip in the vacation period to a country on another continent. "I was not averse to doing as he desired, travel away, and as the duty took me to a land barely mentioned hitherto, the account of my long ago vacation trip may be prefaced by a description of Sunnis, now called Hindustan, or India, and Necropan or Egypt, the most civilized nations not under post supremacy. But a later sentence is interpreted as the Atlanteans was some arrogant towards the Egypt, India civilization, "the differences in the two evil civilizations Atlantis, posed, versus Egypt, India, lay in the fact, that while posed tended to the cultivation of the mechanical arts, to sciences having to do with material things, and were content to accept without question the religion of their ancestors, the Sunni and Necropani paid but little heed to anything not mainly occult and of religious significance practical. Principles truly, Occult laws having a bearing on materiality, but nonetheless were they careless of material objects except insofar as the proper maintenance of life was concerned. Next extract, quote, "We, as Poseidon, knew that the mysterious nations, mentioned Egypt and India, across the waters were possessed of abilities which virtually dwarfed our attainments, such as our power to traverse the aerial or marine depths, our swift cars, our subsurface sea ships. No, they did not boast such conveniences, but they had no need of them to carry on the course of their lives and, therefore, as we supposed, no desire for such apparatus. Perhaps our scorn was more affected than real, for in our more sober thought we acknowledged, with no small admiration, their supremacy." Next extract, quote semicolon, "Of what use our instruments of war even against such a people, a single man of whom, looking with eyes wherein glittered the terrible light of a willpower exerted to hurl in retribution the unseen forces of the night side, could cause Alfman to wither as green leaves before the hot breath of fire?" Page 108, quote, "Were missiles of value here? Of use, when the person at whom they were aimed could arrest them in their lightning path, and make them fall as thistle down at his feet? What, even, was the value of explosives, more awful than nitroglycerin, dropped from Valks poised miles above in the blue vault of heaven? None whatever, for the enemy, with prescient gaze and perfect control of night side forces we knew not of, could arrest the falling destroyer, and instead of suffering harm could annihilate that high ship and its living load. A burnt child fears the fire, and in times past we bad sought to conquer these nations, and failed disastrously. Repulse was all they sought to effect, and successful over us in this, we had been left to go in peace." Next extract, quote semicolon, "Atlantis had learned at last so much of the secret as to wield magnetic forces for the destruction of its foes, and had dispensed with missiles, projectiles, and explosives as agents of defense. But the knowledge of the Sunni today's India was still greater. Greater because our magnetic destroyers spread death only over restricted areas circumjacent to the operator, theirs operated at any desired point, however distant. Ours struck indiscriminately at all things in the fated district, at things inanimate, as well as animate, at men, whether foes or friends, at animals, at trees, all were doomed. Their agencies went out under control, and struck at the heart of the opposing force, not destroying life unnecessarily, nor even molesting any of the enemy except the generals and directors of their forces. Prince Manax asked me that I oblige him by going on a mission to that people. I had never seen the land of Suin and, having a desire to do so, felt well pleased that it was to be gratified." Next extract. Some later in the palace, is told of a fire war campaign from the Atlanteans against the Sunni, India, where the Atlantis army was beaten only by the magical use of a Sunni king who made every man in the attacking army fell to ground as their hearts stopped beating by magic invocation. Part 3. More notes from this book. Prince Manax had apparently lost his son, and the telling person here, Zilm, reminded him of his own son, and thereby he so adopted Zilm as his own son who was graced by this. Manax had also a beautiful dig there, Anzami, who Zilm loved. He had secret wishes to marry her. So from chapter 14. The adoption of Zilm, when, according to request, I arrived at the Agako Palace on the next morning, I proceeded directly to the private office there occupied by Prince Manax, expecting to find my father alone. He was then adopted as so called him his father. But in this I was disappointed, as Rai Gwaksan, emperor, was there with him. The two were in conversation when I entered, and did not cease, evidently not regarding me as an intruder. At last I heard the Rai ask, "Should we not now go to the Incalithlon? If it please thee. And thou, Zilm, the teller of the story here, accompany us." A palace car was summoned by the Rai, and came rolling along into our presence without any person to operate it, came in at the door of the office, which opened to allow its passage precisely as if some court page had opened it. It wheeled into the room and came to a stop in front of us. All this was done exactly as if under a guiding hand. But no visible hand was there. This was the first time I had ever seen any exhibition of occult power on the part of Gwoxon. Indeed, I never saw many examples of his power, notwithstanding his high adeptship. Like all true adepts, he was exceedingly chary of such object lessons, disliking to show his knowledge before those not possessed of sufficient common sense to know that any acts of the sort were but examples of the control of nature through an understanding of higher laws than the ordinary mind perceives in its natural surroundings. But I was not one who saw anything miraculous in the occult, if I understood not the process. I did understand that it was but the operation of some unfamiliar law. Hence Gwoxon was not averse to allowing me to witness his power at times. The car conveyed us to the Vaelks, landing outside, where we found a Vaelks of small size, into which Rai Gwoxon courteously assisted first Mainax, then myself, and himself entered last. Here was a spectacle worthy of note. The ruler of a mighty nation without the display of a single attendant, not more deferential to rank than to those of inferior station. True, as Azio, Inkali, Gwoxon her command over mechanical service which was more regal far than a retinue of menials could be. Like father, like son. Gwoxon, who was as a father to his people, was copied by them in his demeanor. They, too, were simple in habits, courteous in manner, and, though in many cases wealthy and luxurious in their habits in life, were entirely unostentatious, as their Rai set them example. The great temple of Inkal, God, was distant several miles, but a few minutes sufficed to bring us to its huge structure. Outwardly the Inkalithlon was shaped like the Egyptian pyramid of Khops, not quite so high, but covering an area of twice as great extent. No windows pierced its sides, and sunlight or that of day never entered its interior. Besides a number of small apartments, the building contained one vast hall where was space for several thousand worshippers. The posed habit of copying nature was followed in this sanctuary with extraordinary faithfulness. Instead of straight walls, or alcoves, or the ordinary arrangement of interiors, the enormous auditorium was in faithful semblance of a cave of stalactites and stalagmites. In placing all this calcite, utility was consulted with regard to the stalagmites so that too much floor space should not be occupied by them. But the stalactites, being pendant from the marble ceiling, had been placed as thickly as space allowed and sparkled like stars in the light from the incandescent lamps swung midway between them and the floor below. From the latter point of view, these lamps were concealed by broad concave shades so that their glow was wholly invisible from beneath, but shining upwards was reflected from myriads of sparkling white needles, filling the temple with a steady and soft, but powerful, light that seemed to emanate from no special point, but from the air itself, a light well adapted to religious meditation. Inside this pyramid, temple, the Inkalis, or high priest, arose and bade us to follow him into the triangle of the Maxin, or divine light, in front of the holy seat. Deferring the relation of our subsequent action, I will describe this especially sacred part of the temple. It was a raised, triangular platform of red granite, several inches higher than the floor of the auditorium, 36 feet between its points. In the very center of it was a large block of crystal quartz, upon the perfect cube of which rose the Maxin. This seemed aflame, in shape like a giant spearhead, and it cast a light of intense power over all things around, yet one could look at its steady, unwavering white glow without desiring shade for the eyes, even though these were not strong. Over three times the height of a tall man it stood, a mysterious manifestation of Inkal, as all spectators believed. In reality, it was an occultic light, and had stood in that one spot for centuries. It had witnessed the grander development of Posed and its capital city, and had seen the original temple of Inkal, a small architectural structure, unworthy of a great people, torn down, and the present in Kalith long built around it. It made no heat, did not even warm the quartz pedestal, yet for any living being to touch it was fatal in the instant of the rash act. No oil, no fuel, no electric currents fed it, no man tended it. Its history was peculiar, and cannot fail to interest thee, my friends. Many hundred years previously there had been for 434 days a ruler over the Posidi who possessed wonderful knowledge. This wisdom was like that of Ernon of Suan, India. No one knew whence he came, and not a few were disposed to question his statement, while all were in doubt, as to whether his meaning was figurative or literal when he said, I am from Incal. Lo, I'm a child of the sun and am come to reform the religion and life of this people. Behold, Incal is the father and I am the son, and he is in me and I am in him. He was asked to prove this claim, whereupon he laid his hand upon a man born blind, and the man received his sight and saw with the doubters that his deliverer stooped to the pavement of the triangular platform, and with his finger drew a square 5.5 feet either way. Then he stepped outside of the lines indicated, and at once the great block of quartz appeared, a perfect cube, in the place. Standing by its side he placed his finger upon the rock, and blew thereon with his breath, as he withdrew the finger. The Maxin, or fire of Incal, sprang up, and thus had cube and unfed fire remained during all the centuries since. It is needless to say the proof was satisfactory. And thereafter the mysterious stranger revised the laws and provided then the code which had ever since governed the land. He had said that whosoever should add to or take from his laws, that person should not come into the kingdom of Incal until I am come on earth for the final judgment. No one had ever desired to disobey, it would seem, or at least no change had ever been made. The laws which this Ra had given were written by him with his finger upon the Maxin, stone, and no work of sculptor's chisel were better done. They were also written upon a book of parchment leaves, and this he placed under the unfed light itself, which thereafter sprang from the surface of the book. This had remained ever since, unharmed, unscorched. The wonderful writer had placed it there in sight of all the people who could enter the new temple built in place of the old one. As he did so, he said, Hearken unto me. This is my law. Behold it also written on the Maxin, stone. No man shall remove it, lest he die. Yet after centuries have flown, behold the book shall disappear in sight of a multitude, and no man shall know its place. Then shall the unfed light go out, and no man be able to rekindle it. And when these things have come to pass, the day is not far off when the land shall no more be. It shall perish because of its iniquity, and the waters of earth shall roll above it. I have spoken. The day of the dismal prophecy had been looked for as the decades passed into centuries, but its time was not yet come, and though many alarmists set days when it would surely come, it came not, and the unfed light continued. According to the law, bodies of all souls which had passed into Navaisaman were cremated. This even included some animals. But in the days of their youth neither had seemed to expect the preferment which the years had in store, and after the long course required of Zio Incali at the Zio Quithlon, both had hidden the world of men adieu and had gone forth into the solitudes of the vast mountains, where only the sons of Incal had abode, of all mankind. These men were the theocristic or occult adepts of that olden age, the Yog, Vidya of their time. They were indeed chary of their wisdom, then as now, but to Gwaxan and Manan they imparted it without stint. They had no families then, nor do these students of God, of nature, deviate now from the same celibate principles. None who hope to achieve their deep knowledge will mate. After years had flown, so many that men had almost forgotten them, Gwaxan and Manan did what few had ever been known to do. Returned to the haunts of ordinary humanity. My father, Manax, had been but a babe when Gwaxan went away, and the latter's sister was not then born. Yet when Gwaxan came back, the silvery threads of age already gleamed in the hair of the Prince Manax, while as for the Rai that was to be, he looked a little more mature, but otherwise unchanged from the youthful semblance of the days of yore. In the interim, his sister had come to the world, grown to womanhood, wedded Mainax, and after bringing into life their son, Soris, and their daughter, Anzimi, had gone into the undiscovered country through the Maxen Gateway. Mainin, too, was of a similarly youthful appearance. Page 138. Ganj, the capital city of Sunus. I showed her the route, his travel to India, I purposed to take. Together we scanned the map, and I pointed out that from Kfuel on the extreme western cape of Bozd, my course would be east by north across the continent, the intervening ocean beyond it and between that point and further land. Then still on east across the country of Necropan, which country, now called Egypt, Abyssinia, etc., then embraced the entire continent of Africa, one government similar to that of Suan, and was inhabited by a people of kindred powers, but not nearly so far advanced. Africa was then not more than half its present size, while Sunus, which also embraced all of Asia, was much different from what it is today, but it was a name more distinctive of the peninsula of Hindustan. Leaving Necropan, Egypt, the route would be across the sea to India, or, as we knew the names, across the waters of light, in reference to their phosphorescence, to Sunus. From Ganj, capital of Sunus, our course was still eastward across the Pacific Ocean, as it is now named, to our colonies in America, called Inkalia by us, because in that far antipodal land, the sun, Inkal, was fabled as making his bed by that epic heretofore mentioned as the basis of Itlan folklore. From southern Inkalia, America, modern Sonora, I intended to go northwards and skim hastily over the desolate ice fields of the Arctic regions. What is now Idaho and Montana, Dakota, Minnesota, and the Dominion of Canada were then covered with vast glaciers, the rear guard of the glacial epoch, which was slowly retreating, very slowly, even in so late a day, geologically speaking, as the days of it, reluctant to end its frigid reign. The trip could thus be made to afford novel and pleasing contrasts, tropical, semi-tropical, temperate and frigid. Comment Troon. This is interesting information, as also Velikovsky found through his research, that the former position of the North Pole had been not far from the Hudson Bay, as also indicates that the so-called magnetic North Pole, is there positioned. Rho, Rum. The vessel or craft they travelled in, are Vailks. Craft was of the middle traffic size, these vessels being made in four standard lengths, number 1, about 25 feet, 8 meters, number 2, 80 feet, 26 meters, number 3, something like 155 feet, 52 meters, while the largest was yet 200 feet longer than the third size. Men's about 135 meters, these long spindles were in fact round, hollow needles of aluminum, formed of an outer and an inner shell between which were many thousands of double T braces, an arrangement productive of intense rigidity and strength. All the partitions made other braces of additional resistant force. From amidships the vessels tapered toward either end to sharp points. Most Vailksy were provided with an arrangement allowing, when desired, an open promenade deck at one end. Windows of crystal, of enormous resistant strength, were in rows like portholes along the sides, a few on top, and others set in the floor, thus affording a view in all directions. I might mention that the Vailks which I had selected for our vacation trip was 15 feet and 7 inches in its greatest diameter. At the appointed time, the first hour of the third day, as agreed with Mainax, my invited guests assembled at the palace, from the roof of which we were to take our departure. How careful I was of my lovely sister, and how proud of her beauty. The Princess Lilix, whom we had ever treated as a guest of Mainax Ithlon, came up to the platform where the ship lay, curious to see our preparations for departure. It seemed ever new to her to behold an aerial vessel leave terra firma. The current keys were set, and, just as the Vailks trembled slightly ere leaving the roof, long as was our silver, white spindle, We had soon risen so high as to make us seem a mere speck to people on the earth beneath. Then for half an hour we flew at moderate speed through the high abyss, when a young lady called attention to an approaching Valx, following in our wake. Prince Mainax, seated in a deck chair by my side, looked over the rail at the surface, more than 2 miles beneath. Then he drew his heavy fur cape more closely about his shoulders, looked back over the 100 miles, more or less, of our course already covered in the half hour, and remarked that the other Valx was rapidly gaining on us. "Shall I give orders to the Valx, man, to increase speed, that we may enjoy a race?" I asked of the company, which, clad in Arctic clothing, was occupying the passing time in sightseeing round about us on the open deck. "Nay, not so, my son," said Mainax. I said no more, for it at that moment dawned upon me that the pursuer followed us by the prince's order. Mainax now rose, bade the company goodbye and a pleasant trip, and then, Anzimi having arisen also, he put his arm about her and came back to me. As I stood up he passed his disengaged arm around me, and thus we stood for some moments. Then releasing us, he ordered the two deckmen to throw grapples across to the other vessel, which at that moment grated alongside. The next instant he stepped on board the other Valx and signed to loose grapples. Thus we parted, high above the green earth, 2 miles beneath, he to return, we to go onwards. From Chapter 16. The voyage to Suan, today's India, before us lay a pleasure trip during which we should travel many thousands of miles. We proceeded slowly when we came above the base of the huge bulk of Pitach Rock, the mighty mountain, and ascended somewhat, so that we should be on a level with its high point. When at the place, nothing would suit the company except a stop on the summit, and together we all placed foot in the snows on the Pitach, which thing was done chiefly to please Anzimi, who said that the place was very interesting on account of what had there happened to me. Then, again, we were underway, descending from the higher altitudes in order to better view the thickly inhabited, though mountainous, country beneath us, between Pitach Rock and East Post. At the approach of sunset a dull roar arose to the ear, and soon the long white shore of old ocean flashed beneath a moment, and in a little time was Valx behind, with the waters, lead color in the twilight, beneath, behind, before and on both sides, no land in sight. And over 1,000 miles east the country of Necropan. Egypt, without going at a full rate of speed, we could not expect to be above that land in less than 2 or 3 hours. But as it would be dark ere reaching it, we slackened speed to 150 miles per hour, closed the deck and went into the salon, where incandescent lamps lit up the darkening night, glooms. A trip by Valx could never prove so monotonous as a journey in even the fastest of ocean steamships so often is today. The variety of scenery, the wide views possible, for altitude was dependent wholly on pleasure, the external cold being unheeded by people who sat in a parlor warmed by means. Page 147. From Navats and furnished with air of the proper density by the same night side forces. All this tended to prevent ennui. Then too, the rapid transit changed the aspect of things beneath so fast that the spectator looking back, wards gazed upon a dissolving view. As an aside, the currents derived from the night side of nature permitted the attainment of the same speed as that of the diurnal rotation of the earth, e.g., supposing we were at an altitude of 10 miles, and the time the instant of the sun's meridian. At that meridian moment we could remain indefinitely, bows on, while the earth revolved beneath, at approximately 17 miles every minute. Or, the reverse direction keys could be set, and our Valx would speed away from where it was meridian on the surface beneath, at the same almost frightful rate, frightful to one unused to it, as my reader is now, but one day will not be, if, as I hope, he or she will live to see Valxy rediscovered. Nor need the life be a very long one ere then. While we had such preventives of ennui, we lacked not commoner means of enjoyment. We had Anma, in the mirrors and vibrators of which our friends, however distant, could appear in image of form and of voice, life-sized and with undiminished vocal volume. The salons of the great passenger Vailksa had libraries, musical instruments, and potted plants, amongst the flowers of which birds similar to the modern domestic canary darted about.